Realization Congress, Lecture 6, Scientology Definitions, 4.
It just shows you, this has been quite a rush getting down here. I put in two research sessions and administration and half a dozen other things. I even had a moment to eat. I'm still eating, unfortunately. I've more or less knocked off sleeping. That seems to be a waste of time. I put the body in bed, but nothing happened. And here I am ready to give you a lecture without any slightest idea of what to talk to you about. Memory and recall. Well, actually, there is no difference between these two terms that's significant to the auditor. Memory means some remembering something, and recalling means remembering something, and so forth. Now, recall, however, implies that you bring it up to present and look at it. It has that connotation. Whereas memory would have the connotation of you simply knew it had happened. Now, there's two different connotations to these things, but actually they very, very easily interchanged. Very easily interchanged, because one doesn't have to bring it up. When he's clear, he doesn't any longer. There's a lot of things he doesn't bring up to present time to recall them. He can recall them in detail and tell you exactly where they are without having them brought up into the present to review. Do you follow? To that extent, clear is actually far, far in advance of the Book One definition of clear. The reason might amuse you, the reason one can't recall is totally contained in the fact that his memory is surrounded by mass, which prevents him from recalling. It's quite obviously, if you got rid of all of the mass of the mind, why, you obviously wouldn't have anything to recall, correct? Doesn't work that way at all, which is one of the most astonishing things. Undue duress prevents recall. For instance, if you were in a lion's cage and the lion jumped at you and you got out through the bars and you got about 10-15 feet away, the mental energy contained in drawing back from the lion and squeezing out through the bars and running that 10 feet would, in actual fact, not because it's a dangerous area, but prevent you from remembering that you had been in the lion's cage. And that's basically the mechanics of amnesia, of how an individual ceases to remember. The track, you might say, gets too charged. Not that it gets too dangerous, but his recalls fold up on him because he's protecting himself against so many dangers and actions on the track, that very amount of charge or energy or mass and so forth prevents his easy penetration into it. So what he actually starts doing is bringing up the pictures to look at them. He can't just say, my license number in Rome was, you see. He sort of has to get a picture of it in order to read it. You got it? Well, that would only be when his track was very heavily charged and he was mocking up all kinds of charge with relationship to it. Anyway, that's the way it is. And confidence. Confidence is an expression of trust. One could make some witticisms on the subject of money is an idea, and its value is proportional to the confidence in the government. Whose money is inflating? Inflation actually is an expression of no confidence in the government. Just as nasty as that. Now we're talking about philosophic money. We're not talking about economics. The basic ideas which underlie money are simply, it's an idea and a degree of confidence. Money is an idea. Now we have to bolster that idea up and give it substance and give it mass and give it reason and give it economics and give it idiocy and give it ideology. And when we get all through, why, we're having a ball. But it's basically just those two things. It's as valuable as one has confidence. And it is originally an idea. Now, if you work with those two things in relationship to money, you can understand more about money than reading 1,000 texts on economics. You see, when money goes bad is when people cease to have confidence in the issuer. And therefore, money is considered that much less valuable. So on Tuesday, the public likes dictator Benzene, and on Wednesday, they hate him. Well, you'll find out that on Tuesday, the country's money is worth whatever it was worth on the exchange, and on Wednesday, is valueless. That's why they put pictures of kings and presidents and prime ministers and things of this character on money. I try to associate these facts. So confidence is just degree of trust in. Confidence is no absolute term. It's degree of trust. Trust, of course, is composed of past experience. People who don't trust anyone have just had too many past experiences and so forth. Total trust. Total trust is looked on by people as being total idiocy. And as a matter of fact, it happens to be the only condition under which you can exist. That's interesting. Exist online, total trust. Somebody says, well, a thing wrong with Ron is he just trusted everybody, and he always trusts people, and he trusts, you see, and it's all very bad, and so forth. Maybe very bad, but look where we are today. We didn't arrive there being suspicious of everybody. Certainty would mean the degree of willingness to accept the awareness of an isness. Isn't that pretty good? This is what Stone is juggling with words to make more words. I know, you'll have to play it back. I can't remember my song. Now, if there is a potato masher in front of you, as an example, if there is a potato masher in front of you, and if this potato masher is, and if you are willing to accept the fact that it is and are willing to be aware of it, then you have certainty in it. Certainty is one of the most conditional things that anybody ever had anything to do with, because there's a question in the first place, to begin with, that any mass has mass. The physicist plays on this all the time. He's not at all sure that mass has mass. This brings up something else. A Scientologist actually takes off philosophically in this particular direction with relationship to the universe. If he does this, why, he's perfectly safe, and it's all very rational. This is one of the basic problems, by the way, of most philosophers. Somewhere in his texts, there will be this discussion of reality. Now, when we're getting down to reality, we're getting down to the subject of certainty, and we're on the subject of nothing else but certainty. Now, there is a wall. There is a wall. And now, certain philosophers would have you believe that before you can accept the fact that there is a wall there, you have to know from where the wall came. But that is silly. Do you see? So a Scientologist simply starts out not on the basis of, is there a wall there because it came from someplace, or how long the wall is going to be there, or anything else. His sole question with regard to reality is the wall there. The wall is, so therefore he is then certain the wall is. What is he certain of? He is simply certain that the wall is. He doesn't have to be certain of anything else. And this is a reduction to simplicity of one of the greatest philosophic conundrums that philosophers have ever boxed the ears of students with. You have to ask the question, what is, to make people uncertain. That would be the greatest mechanism in the world of the generation of uncertainty. Is the world really? Now you start asking questions about it, you shake people's certainty. Now brainwashing simply is the trick of mixing up certainties. All you have to do if you want to know and extrapolate or develop the entire field of brainwashing as developed by Pavlov for the communists, for use on Russians and others, is simply to make somebody certain that the wall is black and then certain that the wall is white and make it less black and less white and have it eventually become gray. But not have him certain that it is gray at all, leave him with the two certainties that it is white and that it is black. And with those two certainties merged and confused one with the other, he gets into a confused or hypnotic state in which he can believe anything. So to unconfuse somebody, it is only necessary to let them regain some certainties. Therefore, you ask somebody to pat his foot against the floor, as we used to do. Well, he becomes certain that the floor is there. He doesn't have to become certain where it came from, what it's composed of, or how much money is still owed on the mortgage. The only thing you're asking him to do is just to make sure that it is there. And so you get the increase of certainty which is attended in processes such as CCHs and spotting processes and so forth. Quite remarkable. An individual is displaced after he's been in an accident. Because of his mental image pictures made at the time of the accident, he tends to remain at the moment of the accident, and in that moment of time, and in that location in space. Now, he dimly sees the room around him. So he can't be certain, because he sees dimly the accident around him, and he sees dimly the room around him. So he really cannot be certain that he is in the room or in the accident. Now, by asking him to spot the room, gradually we increase his certainty so that he becomes unconfused. Then he feels straighter and more comfortable. His certainty is up. Do you see? Now, he probably also could run the engram out so that he couldn't be there. And then have him look at the room, and we would accomplish more or less the same end product. Either of which would increase his certainty as to the isness of his current location. And certainty is, of course, trust, and so forth, mixed up again, similar to confidence. When you're walking down steps and there isn't one there and you were certain that it was, this is a betrayal, the end of which you never heard of. And it does more than jar your spine. You also get into ARC breaks. One quite often ARC breaks because one's certainty suddenly is shifted. He thinks he's looking at a gilly wobbit, and he actually finds himself looking at a gula woobit. One of the ways of teaching people so as to render them into a total hypnotic state is practiced in most universities. And that is to qualify every statement in such a way as it's not quite graspable. The Alahippatudrum lived in the Cleocene period, except where he was in the Mongoic period, and Professor Wumptigump challenges that he lived at all. typical one of this type of operation. The actual statement should be made is, these bones was found in Tar Pit X. In order to be able to talk about them, we call them Hoosis bones. Now take it from there, kid. Build yourself a Tyrannosaurus Rex if we want to, but as far as we know, it's Hoos's bones. Big certainty. You probably developed a terrific paleontologist if you did. Generality. Any unspecificity or unspecific statement or indication tends toward a generality. It is the substitution of a plural for a singular, or a substitution of a greater for a lesser. And a generality is implied, it implies that generality is used more or less purposely. Actually, individuals who are pretty dispersed or, you know, sort of all around and hazy and so forth tend to talk in generalities. Bill, who just talked to them, becomes they. A letter just received from the public about the magazine becomes the public. Unspecific, and it's actually blowing up a smaller to a larger or a singular to a plural. And that's what's known as generalizing. Now, the whole system and subject of classification comes under the head of generalizing or generalities, but isn't looked upon normally as doing so, and it's called classification. In other words, the word boys includes all boys. The word girls includes all girls. Well, now, that word itself, of course, is a generality, and you naturally, to converse at all, must have that word. But because you do have a generality, when they are in actual fact boy, 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 and girl, 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 and really not girls, there is no such thing as a girls. Really, really, they're just a bunch of girl. Repeated several times. Because that generality has been condoned, then you get into a further generality, a much larger generality, and you get men are no good, you know. Everybody, or boys don't like me. You see? That's a hell of a generality. I've never failed, by the way, in exploring with a meter, I've never failed to find out who they was. And it was always one person. They, instead of Joe. Very interesting. Generality. You have, in actual fact, one of the sources of aberration, and you certainly have a big answer to suppression when you have this whole subject of generality explained and understood. Suppress, and we immediately have the primary mechanism of suppression would be generality. But suppress means to squash, to sit on, to make smaller, to refuse to let reach, to make uncertain about his reaching, to render or lessen in any way possible, by any means possible, to the harm of the individual and for the fancied protection of the suppressor. And that is what it means technically in Scientology. The suppressor, considering himself in danger from something, will try to suppress it. And the suppression of it, and so on, is done in many ways, and covertly is done by expressing generalities to it. You are surrounded by dangerous space. Typical. A fellow standing out in an open field full of daisies, and somebody tells him, "Don't move!" The fellow says, "Why, why?" He doesn't ever tell him. Matter of fact, invention of things or the outlining of things like germs that nobody has seen tends to be a bit suppressive. You get a mama who tells you that everything is covered with germs, Johnny. See, these are all tricks and mechanisms to prevent reach. And that's why you don't have people in sudden overwhelming comprehension of what you're doing when you try to talk to them. And you find out there's some people that will listen to you and some people won't. Well, It is the state of beingness of the person that determines whether or not he will listen to it. Now, this odd phenomenon occurs. An individual asked to look at his mind as causative, or even even as an effect, gets into a state of such terror or anxiety, rather than to look into himself or recognize himself in any way at all, that he instantly goes frenziedly mad. Just literally that. See? Now, you'd get the, you're not, it's hard to explain by keeping it in that frame of reference. But supposing we were sitting around an arena and they let in a hungry man-eating tiger. And you said to Joe, sitting alongside of you, who was never noted for his courage, and you said to Joe, "Now, Joe, jump over the railing there and wrestle with him for a while. Or put him back in his cage or something like this. But jump over the railing there and have to do with this tiger." And he would think you were joking at first. But when you start forcing him to jump over the railing, and you're going to throw him over the railing, you would have a rather terrified, fighting, snarling, screaming individual who is liable to say most anything. You get that state of mind? All right. When you tell Joe Aloysius Suppressi to look at his mind, you're producing exactly the same effect as telling him to jump over the rail and wrestle with a man-eating tiger. It is so terrifying to him to look at breakfast this morning for fear of what he would find, because he knows what's going to happen to him. He's going to get his block knocked off. See, by accident, one time he looked inside, and he's never been sane since. They're not arguing with you as to whether or not Scientology works or doesn't work or is valid or isn't valid. And they're not trying to disprove it. They're not trying to disprove it. People will think badly of it. There's no doubt in their mind whatsoever but what you could make them do things, and it terrifies them. And quite in addition to this, why, you're liable to, he knows, trigger him off in some way so that he would go mad. That's what they talk to you all the time. Isn't it dangerous? Dangerous. People look at their minds, you know. Isn't it dangerous? It is, isn't it? We have some psychiatrists that says it is. Tell me it doesn't work. And they think they're proving themselves as public benefactors by discrediting it so people won't look at it and thus have to look at their minds and look at their beingness and look at their track and look at their yesterday. You follow. But that, completely aside from somebody else becoming more powerful, is the thing which spurs that reaction. You talk to somebody sometime, you've had the experience, you say, "Oh, well, a thing called Scientology, and actually you can communicate better and so forth. All you have to do is confront your life a little bit and do something with the mind, improve the mind slightly." The fellow looks at you and he just suddenly goes, "Huh? Well, isn't that terrible fellow, Hubbard? And then that awful thing? And, well, and awful, isn't it? Pretty awful. I don't see why you do such a thing. Why do you do such things? Isn't it true that you boil babies and eat them alive and so forth? And blah, 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 blah." He's a terrible risk if you just said, "Look at your mind. Look at your mind." He's going to scream. Now, you see, he is below being able to be the effect of anything, even an automaticity. So that when you bring him upscale, the first thing he has to confront, that he might possibly be the effect of a thing called the mind. And right away, he goes, sping! And he actually goes a bit insane. Those people are below the average level and are below the level of insanity. If they came upscale, he'd go mad. You see? But they're walking around, all right. As long as they're just in a total automaticity as they walk through their daily lives, they know they won't be insane. And they take some tranquilizers and the doctors and so forth, and they're depending on somebody else, and somehow or other they'll go through their lives. But, no, I didn't go mad today, you know. Now, that is the being that tries to give you a beating by criticizing you for helping your fellows. You can't criticize anybody for trying to help his fellow man, trying to help himself. Anybody tries, it's insane. Yes, that's right, they're insane. But that's why they're insane. But what's interesting here is that there was a way up and a road out. But it normally would never have been pursued, because philosophers are more or less thoughtful types. And they are noted, some of them, for messiahs and so on, are noted for going and getting themselves killed and martyred for their beliefs and so forth. But very few philosophers actually stand up very strongly when the firing squad starts marching down the street, you know. Not even Voltaire did. He sort of talked reasonably. But when you have a breakthrough like this, it's usually a do or be damned sort of a breakthrough. It isn't made in a scholarly fashion. It is made more or less as well, to hell with it, you know. Here goes nothing, you know. You have to have a guy who'll drive a car 190 miles an hour if it'll go that fast, you know, on a rainy night. A person to follow up the line of Scientology would have to be either tremendously reassured in a very quiet environment for a considerable period of time, if he was terribly bad off, you see. I'm not now even talking about the insane. I'm talking about more or less what's accepted as normal. He'd have to be calmed down pretty much and be in pretty good shape, and then you could probably get him to confront something. You see? That's why you have a failure going out here and selecting people for PCs, you know, that the percentage is not high. But the percentage does exist. And because it isn't high, there's no reason you shouldn't do it. Because it isn't high, why, don't let that make you cease to try. You're, in actual fact, are collecting on the planet the upper 10% of the upper 10% of the planet. You're not collecting anything more than that. Now, when you got that, when you've got the upper 10% of the upper 10%, why, then there's some possibility, if you could exert enough influence on the environment, possibility, what I'm understanding, horrible understatement, whereby you could calm the environment down so that people would disinterbulate to a point where they could more easily confront. Do you see? And there is the secret. You never want to treat the insane. The insane should have a nice, quiet courtyard to sit in with a still object in it someplace and be fed regularly with nobody worrying them at all for quite a period of time. You'd find out that there is no cure for the insane. There is no cure for it. You can, however, get the guy to down to his level of confront. What can he confront? He can confront being still in a still environment. He can confront one solid, stable object, or something like this, in his environment. And you can then let him destimulate, disinterbulate, and he will go sane on you. There's not even any reason to work at it. No reason to work at it at all. Now, to throw him through the engram that makes him insane, well, he hasn't got an engram that makes him insane. They can very often run engrams and that sort of thing. But he doesn't have engrams that make him insane. Do you understand? He is insane because his ability to confront the environment in his immediate vicinity is so low that he could never possibly take his mind off of his environment long enough to look at his mind. Too dangerous. Now, just as your super screaming suppressive screams when you tell him to confront his mind, the psychotic screams when you tell him to confront the environment. Now, you've had possibly successes with cases that erroneously pronounced things. Some guy was just a little bit daffy, or he was just a little bit tired, or he was just screaming slightly more than the average human. And you snapped him back to battery, and it was all very miraculous. No reason why processing is any answer to the insane at all. A very, very calm, quiet environment with nobody bothering them at all, where the guy feels totally safe, would undoubtedly permit him to destimulate to a point where he would then be sane. How long he'd be sane, that's something else. How crazy is the environment you move him from there out to? How gradual do you move him? What gradient do you use in taking him from a total stillness to a little bit of motion? Now, insanity is a study in environments, not a study in the mind. Now, when you get the fellow up there so that he passes for sane, now he could confront some tiny little gradient of his mind. Possibly, if your gradient was small enough, and then you would get into the field of the mind. Do you understand? Postulate means to generate or thunk a concept. A concept is a think, a thought. And to postulate, however, to postulate infers a requirement that something goes, or it stays, or turns white, or goes blue, or remains blue, or that it is something, or that it isn't something, or that some action is going to take place, so forth. In other words, a postulate infers conditions and actions rather than just plain things. Now, when an individual says, lovely day, he's not making a postulate. When he says, lovely day, and the sun doesn't instantly turn on and move up in three or four shades of brightness, and if leaves don't immediately start appearing on the dead trees and so forth, well, he would consider his postulate hadn't worked. Postulate is associated more with intention than it is with the thought. It has a dynamic connotation. And having this simply is the feeling that one owns or possesses. Having. Now, a fellow actually can be wearing a coat without having a coat. So it must be the feeling that one owns, has, or possesses, or that the group owns, has, or possesses. And then it becomes havingness. Mere possession does not make havingness. And confronting means the ability to front up to. That word front is very important in confront. Now, confronting, by derivation, would mean with fronting. So it sort of has a dim implication that if you confront the door is confronting you. There's co-action is implied here, but in actual fact doesn't exist in our meaning of it. It means the ability of the individual to face up, look at, stand in front of, be near, see, visualize, or otherwise perceive something. So you say he isn't confronting cats. That means one does not look at, stand up to, and so forth, and by extension won't handle cats. To handle things, you have to stand up to them. You know? Now, there's many a Thetan has been very badly steamrolled by confronting. And he learns this rather easily in a body, and he can also learn it as a Thetan. There's times to stand up and glare, and times not to. So the total answer is not total confronting. Total confronting is not implied. But when an individual can selectively confront or not confront, anything, quaternity, of course, is total power. And it happens that these do go together. When a Thetan does not want to confront something, he tends to mask it, turn away from it, and it tends to make him an effect. Now, if he cannot bring about, make an effect on it, it can make an effect on him. That is the connotation. But as a matter of fact, to stand in front of a 60-mile-an-hour automobile and let it run over you just to demonstrate that you're not afraid of confronting it is not sanity, that's asininity. Now, you ask the individual, are you willing to confront being run over by a 60-mile-an-hour traveling individual or by an automobile or something? And he, of course, is very, very searching about this. Well, if he gets too searching about it, you can realize his confront is out just on the basis that he is already obsessively confronting, and he thinks that there's some sense in your asking him to do what this. And he has the idea that there's something wrong with him, that he won't go do this. Well, I assure you there would be something very wrong with him if he did. So, willful and knowing act, or willful and knowing confronting, or willingness to conceive the idea of, or to confront or not to confront. All are contained in this single idea. Don't get the idea that on confronting that you've got to be able to stand up to any circumstance, in any action, in any anything can ever happen to anybody, because that would simply be to confess that you couldn't stop anything from occurring. Now, you see, I'm perfectly willing to confront being able to put out my palm, quote unquote, in a straight arm on a 60-mile-an-hour traveling automobile and have it stop. And then, therefore, to that degree, perfectly willing to confront. Now, this doesn't mean conditional confronting. What would be the conditions under which you would be willing to confront this? These are really not fair questions. Well, who wants to live a life of ruin? Nobody. Well, now some people have made it a virtue to be able to confront living a life of ruin. Well, it's a kind of a philosophic booby trap. And they persuade individuals that they should be perfectly willing to live a life as dope addicts, bums, and in total ruin in order to demonstrate that they can confront living this kind of a life. But that's simply suppression. Actually, it has precious little to do with sanity, but it's a terrific process in that the individual will come up and find out what he is obsessively confronting as well as what he is willing to confront, and what he doesn't have to confront. And the big thing he normally finds out about something like this is, good heaven, he doesn't have to go on and keep confronting forever. He's, matter of fact, quite tired of standing there. As the power to confront and not to confront arises selectively, an individual's self-determinism arises accordingly. Because very often, Thetan, who never likes to be wrong, explains the fact that he got run over by X by saying he was perfectly willing to confront it, and he was perfectly willing to confront the experience, and he's very happy that he got run over by X because he's now got such an experience, and he could never have another experience. You often hear him say, well, it was a good experience, but I never want to do it again. What was the matter with his arrangement of spatial objects and velocities and so forth that he had to stand there in the first place? That was a much more burning question. It's purely a humanoid type thinking that you can't do anything about anything. This is deadly and disastrous in its connotations, telling him that he must be able to confront anything. All right, he must be able to confront anything. Great. Now, to imply that because he is willing to confront everything, he must confront everything. We have an SP at work. Nothing but. Because the truth of the matter is, above this level, the individual has some control over his environment. And so we find it utterly silly to confront the soup kettle falling off and spilling all over the floor and burning the baby as a necessary thing to confront. As a matter of fact, it's a rather a comment upon one's ability to pick up soup kettles in midair, scoop them down, pick up the soup that is also falling in the air, and set it on the stove and not waste all the dinner. But when one loses that ability, then he says, well, at least I can confront it. All right, well, we've run out of time, and there it is, and I will leave you confronting your sins. Thank you very much. Thank you.